Makeshift Stories presents Somewhere, Sometime, an irregular series of short sci-fi and fantasy stories.
Extraterrestrial visitors, advanced civilizations lost from history, hauntings, supernatural influences, lizard people, and the conspiracy theories that hide them. All are fertile ground for the pseudoscientific documentaries and TV series which inhabit the backwaters of specialty channels and streaming video services. I'm sure we've all seen one, or may even be a fan. While many are simple flights of fantasy, do a few hold a kernel of truth? In this month's story, after listening to an unusual doctoral thesis that makes outlandish claims about music and the nature of the universe, an archaeologist finds himself gradually coming to believe that the crackpot theory may have some truth to it. We invite you now to sit back and relax as you listen to Makeshift Stories 95, Music of the Spheres. Somewhere in some time, you might be able to hear the planets sing. I will never forget Masuyo Hananda's doctoral thesis defense. Originally titled An Examination of Harmonic Intervals in Western Music, and at the last minute withdrawn and replaced with, well, something that made outlandish, groundless claims that reached far beyond her subject area into my field. It was, to say the least, one of the more unusual doctoral presentations I've ever sat through. Masuyo had come to the university after a 7-year absence from academia. Her resume simply stated that after graduating with a Master's of Music Theory from the Conservatory of Music in Kyoto, she traveled. To where and why, and for such a long time, she never revealed. And Masuyo had left no trace online either. No trail of impulsively posted indiscreet moments or boastful selfies at exotic locations. No innocuous comments. There was nothing at all. Those years are a complete blank. I often wondered what she had done during those 84 mysterious months. Knowing might be the missing piece to explain what happened. Explain how she had come upon her outlandish ideas and whether or not they are true. And yes, I'm still not sure about that. The opening remarks of her defense, which immediately put her at odds with her thesis committee, are burned into my memory.
The official history of Western music,
she began, letting her breath out as if she'd been holding the words in for far too long,
is at best a misinterpretation. It's a false front which keeps us comfortably ignorant of reality. Truth is hidden in plain sight in the music of the spheres. And the truth is that the great harmony of the cosmos has been lost, and we are paying for this every day.
Without looking around the room, I could feel surprise followed by bristling anger. Masuyo's committee, with the exception of myself, were all long-standing members of the Music Academy. All were thoroughly steeped in the Western tradition. It was an unexpected opening and appeared to be an intentional front, designed to provoke a reaction. In hindsight, it makes sense. It was directed at me, not the rest of her committee. But at the time, as the outside representative on the committee, I was taken aback and confused. Dr. Gardner, the chair of the music theory department and Masuyo's thesis advisor, asked the obvious question.
Miss Ananda, he began diplomatically, I don't see how your opening statement is relevant to your thesis.
Which version do you have, Dr. Gardner?
The final draft, of course. The one we reviewed together 2 weeks ago in preparation for your defense.
Oh, no. Sorry, there's a more recent edit. Didn't you get it? I emailed it to all of you.
The committee shook their heads in confusion and mumbled complaints. Gardner calmed them down, then addressed his upstart grad student.
It's a bit unusual to make changes so close to the defense. I'm not sure we can allow it.
I sent you the email 10 days ago,
she insisted.
I didn't hear back from you, so I thought it was fine. I thought the committee had read the final edit. But that's okay. I've printed several copies just in case.
Masuyo leaned over and pulled a small stack of spiral-bound documents from a plastic shopping bag she had leaned against the lectern.
Dr. Jung?
She asked, staring at me. I was the closest committee member to the lectern.
Can you hand these out for me, please?
Gardner flipped open his laptop, pecked away at the keyboard, read the results of his efforts, and his face reddened.
I don't understand. There it is. But I just went through my email an hour ago, and I didn't see it. But as you say, it was sent 10 days ago.
Vindicated, Maceo smiled knowingly. And that's when I first suspected there was something else well beyond the scope of her work at the academy. Something that was being directed at me. Unsure how to react, the rest of the committee sat in stunned silence. Gardner started to search for the rules and regulations on his computer. Finally, he leaned away from his laptop and massaged his temples with a pained expression.
Although I've never heard of a situation like this before, there's nothing in the regulations to disallow it.
I examined the cover of the revised thesis as I handed them out, noting it sported a large tetractus, 10 points arranged in neat rows starting with 4 at the base, then descending by 1 at a time, until the 4th row contained a single point, which formed the apex. Thin lines joined the points, forming 9 smaller triangles. It was one of the ancient symbols used by an obscure secretive sect of the Pythagoreans. The title, centered under the detractus in a large Times Roman font, read, "The Music of the Spheres, Discord, and the Decline of World Harmony." The symbol used in relation to the music of the spheres made sense to me. Both were made up of 10 elements, 10 dots in the tetrachus, and 10 theorized celestial bodies in the Pythagorean universe, which made the music of the spheres. The number 10 was sacred and omnipotent to that ancient sect. I was sure that the other members of the committee did not make the connection. After I handed Gardner a copy, he quickly scanned the first few pages, then sank back into his seat, defeated.
"There's nothing in the regulations," he repeated. "But Miss Ananda..."
Gardner paused to think, absentmindedly tapping Masail's new thesis on his lap.
"I can't act as your advocate unless you withdraw this version. And I'd strongly recommend that you do. I'm hoping that this is some kind of odd prank."
"It's not a prank, Dr. Gardner,"
Masail responded, polite but firmly.
"The truth is too important to ignore. So I'll beg the committee's indulgence and proceed."
Despite the grumbling, myself included, Maceo ignored us and plunged on, digging herself in deeper.
"The current version of history claims that the Greeks found a limited number of musical intervals harmonious to their ears. Ratios such as 2 to 1, which is an octave, 2 to 3 a fifth, and 3 to 4 a seventh, etc. There are others, of course. So why those specific proportions between the notes? After all, they could be any interval we might imagine. Indian music, for example, has 22 tones in an octave."
"What's your point?" Gardner interrupted impatiently. "Any first-year student could tell us that, Miss Ananda."
"Those ratios were not inherently natural, that's my point. But the choice was, and is, extremely intentional, Dr. Gardner."
"Yes, yes. We all know the Greeks love whole number ratios, Miss Ananda. Let me repeat my question. What is your point?"
Gardner's patience had run out, but Maceo ignored the implied threat and continued.
"Those ratios, Dr. Gardner, are reflected in the orbits of the planets as well, and the tones they make as they move through the cosmos. And because we're all born with the planet's song in our minds, we can no longer hear it. It's just a background that we ignore. But recently, the tones have subtly changed. The harmony is being lost. The cosmos is being detuned."
I knew this last statement would push the committee over the top and brace myself for what was to come next. But at the same time, I found myself wanting to know where she would take this.
"Pseudoscientific garbage,"
Gardner blurted out. The other committee members nodded in agreement and whispered amongst themselves. Oblivious to their reaction, Maceo pushed on.
"This detuning extends to musical notes as well. I first noticed the phenomena in the lab when I compared a recent recording to one from 1870 made on a phonoautograph. Similar to the music of the spheres, We've been acclimated to contemporary tones, so no one except me has noticed this. But we should have suspected it. The signs are all around us. As you know, the Pythagoreans discovered elegant ratios in the distances between the orbits of the planets, which create harmonious vibrations that saturate and protect our world.
Susan Pringle, the head of the music history department, barely choked back a laugh.
And now I suppose you're going to say that you can hear the planets.
Miss Sale smiled knowingly.
You can if you quiet the noise in your mind, Dr. Pringle. If you purge your mind of all remembered sound and listen with newborn ears again, you can hear it too.
Dr. Pringle threw her hands back in frustration.
And what, pray tell, are they singing? What are they telling you? That we are in trouble. As I continue to stress, their orbits and hence their tones were designed to protect us, to create harmony in the world.
Miss Ananda, Dr. Gardner cut in. Why are you wasting our time? Even if we could accept this line of thinking, as bizarre as it is, you have not presented a rational argument. You are making disjointed leaps of logic. What are your sources? What is the basis of your ridiculous thesis?
Miss Sale stood still, and her face became clouded, as if she was struggling, going through some inner turmoil. Then she suddenly recovered, straightened her shoulders, and looked directly at Gardner.
My source is myself. I was there, Dr. Gardner. I am one of the Pythagorean advisors. I taught them how to balance the music of the spheres.
For a brief moment, the committee sat, dumbfounded. Then laughter broke out.
This is a joke, right? Someone said. Gardner's playing a joke on us.
The world will experience bad times until the harmony is restored.
Maseo tried to shout over the rising commotion, but only I heard her warning. And something in that voice sent a chill through me. Gardner finally called an end to the defense, and the odd presentation was over. The next day, Maseo withdrew from the music academy and disappeared again. Curious about why she had chosen to devolve into pseudoscience in a subject area that I was familiar with, and why she had chosen me as the external member of her committee, I tried to find her online, but after a few months gave up and put the whole incident out of my mind. Soon after that debacle, I left, lured away by a lucrative research grant from the Department of Antiquities at the University of the Aegean. I spent the next 5 years in the field, excavating newly discovered Greek ruins around the Mediterranean. But 2 months ago, I was asked to investigate the authenticity of what appeared to be the ruins of a Greek temple in a most unusual location, on a bluff overlooking the isolated rolling hills and the southwestern prairies of Canada. As you can imagine, it was a highly controversial find, one that I and the Department of Antiquities wanted to thoroughly debunk before it was publicly announced. Even a hint that the site was anything more than a hoax or the remains of some eccentric person's failed obsession to build a monument to themselves would encourage the fanatics and conspiracy theorists. We could not afford to have potential donors divert badly needed money to research crackpot notions that would eventually go nowhere. However, a recent discovery made me question my conviction. I was working with a graduate student excavating a flat stone slab that appeared to have been artificially shaped. Ash from an ancient cook fire found nearby at the same depth, radiocarbon dated to between 750 and 500 BC. This was the first datable material we had found and made the likelihood of a hoax improbable. The location faced west, overlooking a weathered valley that had been carved into the prairie landscape at the end of the last ice age. The light from the setting sun cast long shadows which highlighted small depressions in the surface of the stone we were working on. Then aided by the deep shadows, I saw it for the first time, a perfect detritus which had almost been completely eroded away by the elements, and it reminded me of the detritus in the cover of Maseo's thesis. I hadn't thought about her or her cryptic warning about the changing of the music of the spheres
in years. As we photographed the symbol, a wind picked up, blowing dust into our eyes. A bank of ominous green clouds, which we hadn't noticed before, were rapidly moving in from the north, rolling across the plains, shrouding the land underneath in a blackness darker than midnight. Knowing what was about to come, we immediately abandoned our work to take shelter in the dig trailer, and as I sat there, listening to golf ball-sized hail pound the metal sides, I reflected on the last 5 years. I have always tried to avoid finding patterns where there are none to find, and as an archaeologist, it is paramount not to do so. But I couldn't prevent myself from wondering, the increase in erratic weather, like the storm we were sitting through in what essentially should be an arid wasteland, the minor wars of recent years, the unstable economy and earthquakes all around the Ring of Fire, especially in New Zealand. I normally would not connect these things, knowing that if I looked at the scientific data, there would be no pattern to them. But after finding the detritus in a ruin that should not be where it is, I found myself suddenly open to other possibilities. However, I decided to keep the significance of the symbol to myself. To anyone else in the team, it would just appear to be an odd petroglyph, a one-off, etched into the rock by the member of an indigenous culture, an unusual form for this region of the world, but nothing more, and certainly not proof that the site had once been occupied by Greeks. On a whim, I tried to clear my mind and listen, but the hail drumming against the metal walls of the trailer drowned everything else out. That night, back at the hotel, lying on the overstuffed bed, hoping to distract myself, I turned the TV on and began to channel hop. I'd gone through all the listings twice and was about to turn the stupid thing off when a familiar face flashed by. I flipped back and watched, fascinated. The title in the lower third of the screen identified her as Dr. Masao Hananda, Director, International Ancient Extraterrestrial Research Center. When and where, and in what, had she finished her doctorate, I wondered. She spoke in a confident, measured tone that gave her words the weight of authority.
Extraterrestrials not only visited the world between 1000 and 500 BC,
she asserted, as if this was a well-known fact,
but assisted some of the greatest cultures of the Aegean, guiding their science and intellectual evolution. The early Greeks in particular were influenced in their development of mathematics and the systems of proportions, which they were led to understand formed the basis of the physical universe, describing everything from the tonal differences between musical notes to the movement of planets. And the orbits of the planets were tuned, the extraterrestrials knew, to create tones of energy which dictate the quality of life on Earth. But what's next is where it really gets interesting, where the rubber of ancient alien research hits the road, so to speak. And now, we're all going to have to pay the price.
The program broke away to commercials. Her delivery, I had to admit, had improved dramatically, but it was the same half-baked detritus of pseudoscience, conspiracy theory, and pop mysticism she had used in her thesis presentation. Oddly, I found myself hooked. The ads ended, and Masao was back on screen.
"And we all are going to pay the
price," she repeated.
"The extraterrestrials helped Pythagoras form a secret sect of Pythagoreans to monitor the motion of the planets and keep the whole system in balance using the power of energy vortexes found along ley lines that grid the Earth. The group is not documented in any official
history." She air-quoted with her fingers.
"This elusive sect of devoted Pythagoreans, aided by the aliens, built a series of temples on every continent at the 10 major energy vortexes. These were used to keep the harmony of the cosmos in balance."
A montage of archaeological sites flashed across the screen, ending with a shot of a bluff overlooking an ancient river valley, not far from our dig.
"For some unknown reason, they were abandoned, allowing the perfect pitch of the universe to drift off key. Most of these sites are yet to be rediscovered.
She proclaimed as the credits began to roll. I lay there stunned. No information about the Canadian site's existence had been released, and none would be, until we were certain what we were dealing with. I spent the rest of the night trying to track down any information I could find online about Masail's last few years, but only one reference existed. A post from the producer of the Ancient Alien Invasion series in which she was appearing, mentioning how she had met Dr. Hernanda by chance in a Manila cyber cafe. The post ended with a mysterious question. Was this accidental? I'm not sure why my hands were sweating on the steering wheel as I drove the rental to the airport to pick up Maceo. I hadn't told the other team members what I was doing. They would have scoffed at me for inviting a parascientist to the dig site. Instead, I simply stated the truth that I had been on Maceo's doctoral thesis review committee, and that she had an unusual perspective on our work. Maceo watched the rolling foothills slide by the side window of the car as we drove out to the site, avoiding conversation. Finally, I had to ask, "What happened after you left the music academy?"
"You're still avoiding the truth,"
she countered, then said nothing more. After meeting the other members of the dig team, Maceo insisted on a site tour. Tired from a long day, no one volunteered to help, so I eventually found myself walking through the dig alone with Maceo, pointing out where we had found the foundations of a colonnade. When we finally arrived at the place where I had discovered the detritus, Maceo stared at the faded outline, then suddenly smiled.
"There were no other artifacts? Not surprising."
Her voice trailed off. "No," I responded. "And that's odd. It's as if the site was stripped, then intentionally buried. If it wasn't for the radiocarbon dating, I would have assumed it was a fake. It was found by pure accident, a paleontologist looking for a new bone bed." Maceo stood for a moment, silently examining the detritus, then knelt down and carefully traced out its connecting lines with a finger. She got up and turned to face me.
"It's been so long, too long. But now the great project can finally be completed. The means is still available. The energy here is strong."
Maceo pointed to the stone where the detritus had been carved. The symbol now looked as if it had just been etched into the rock. "What?" I gasped. "Is this a trick?" Suddenly, the earth seemed to move, everything jumping from the left, then to the right. It wasn't an earthquake. It was more like a misregistered frame in an old celluloid movie jumping in the projector gate. "What just happened?" I asked.
"It will start soon now," she muttered cryptically.
"What will?"
"The detuning. The power is still here to complete it."
She closed her eyes and concentrated.
"And now, it has been set in motion again. The work that I came here to do is finished. Your world will fall deeper into discord, as it was meant to be. Thank you, Doctor. I followed your career, and knew that you would be the one that would be called when this place was discovered to dispute what it appears to be. My thesis, its defense, my appearance as an expert on those silly shows, all just dots for you to connect, to create a map that would bring me here."
"You're not making any sense," was all I could think to say, but I knew that something significant had just happened, and I had aided it. The wind suddenly picked up, and a dark cloud appeared from nowhere. Dropping down from its turbulent center was a light so bright that I had to look away. It rushed down toward us. There was a thunderclap, then the light, the cloud, and Maceo were gone. I knew no one would believe me if I told them about the cloud that devoured my guest, so I let the whole incident drop, and soon after filed my initial findings with the Ancient Antiquities Department at the University of the Aegean. Between the discovery of the detritus and the radiocarbon dating, I could come to no other conclusion than to confirm the site as authentic. 1 month later, my grant was withdrawn, and 6 months after that, a new report was issued by the university denouncing the site as an extremely sophisticated fraud. To my relief, the report exonerated me, noting that a new and more reliable method of dating had been used, one which I didn't have access to, proved beyond a doubt that the site was between 15 and 20 years old, and that this was the only way the fake could have been exposed. My professional reputation was intact, but my confidence had been thoroughly shaken. The new date placed a fraudulent site's construction during the period when Maseo had disappeared between her master's and doctoral programs. I must admit that I felt used and deceived, but there was still part of me that wanted to believe in her. Another 3 years passed. I may be connecting the dots where there is nothing to connect, but, well, look at the news. New wars, earthquakes, crop failures, and their frequency seems to be increasing. I know it's a subjective response. I'm not a statistician, and I'm very cognizant of that. However, I read somewhere online that the orbit of Mercury was subtly changing, and wondered if the detuning would soon be complete. I tried to clear my mind and memory of all sound, and listened for the music of the spheres. Thanks for listening to Makeshift Stories 95, The Music of the Spheres. We hope that you've enjoyed this month's episode. As always, if you like what we're doing, please tell your friends about us, or write a review on iTunes, or Stitcher Radio, or check us out on Google Plus and Facebook. We love hearing your comments, so send us an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com, or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. And thanks to those who have already emailed us from all over the world. We release a new story every month, approximately between the 15th and the 20th. To listen to Makeshift Stories on your iOS or Android device, please download Stitcher Radio from iTunes or the Google Play Store. This month's episode was written and read by Ellen B. Hare. The opening and closing themes were composed and recorded by David Hume. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons non-attribution, no derivative license, which means you're free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.